Welcome to Audio Notes. I'm Nikki Sweat, your host. The first carte blanche recital of this Joseph Haydn-themed Music at Menlo season is a concert featuring four of Haydn's piano sonatas, given by Gilbert Kalish on Friday, July 15th. The works included provide snapshots of different periods in Haydn's long and prolific life as a writer of solo piano music. We often think of him as an innovator in the realm of string quartets or symphonies, but he also did a lot to develop the genre of the piano sonata, in many ways setting the stage for what Mozart, Haydn, and the Romantics would eventually do. The earliest composed piece featured on this program is the sonata in A-flat major, HOB 1646. Haydn wrote this work in the late 1760s, shortly after he assumed the position of full Kapellmeister in the Esterházy court. It was a major promotion and led to a period where he could fully explore his experimental impulses. His desire to play and to push at inherited practices, particularly in the realm of harmony, comes through very clearly throughout the A-flat major sonata. The first movement starts out innocently enough with an easygoing allegro moderato theme. He creates motion and conflict by setting that stately theme in contrast to flowing triplets. In a few places, he comes to a long-held chord, then modulates somewhere else by starting with a naked chromatic line, an early example of a markedly Haydnian gesture. The movement has one of my favorite development sections in Haydn's sonata repertoire, full of sequence-driven twists and turns. It winds carefully to presentations of the initial theme in various keys, so we hardly notice when the recapitulation section begins. The second movement of this sonata has a distinctive opening texture, a rolling accompaniment figure which is eventually joined by a trill-filled aria. The first section ends with a touching set of syncopated thirds. An analogous closing passage occurs in the second half of the movement, only those thirds do not lead to a close but to a mysterious and powerful, harmonically adventurous diversion, further evidence that Haydn's innovative spirit was at play even in these earlier compositions for solo piano. Thank you. Presto finale is perhaps more standard fare. It's based on a playful tune with a winking syncopation. Quick, swelling figures get passed between the hands. And each section ends with a playful and satisfying gambit. Haydn gives us a variety of crunchy chromatic options for the figures we've heard throughout the movement, swinging in and out of dissonance to exaggerate the release of the final cadences. For the rest of this session, I want to talk about one theory of what makes Haydn's music particularly good at communicating different characters and feelings. It's a theory that was put forth by an early public advocate for Haydn's chamber music, the mid-20th century broadcaster and critic Hans Keller. The story he tells goes like this: meaning in instrumental music is all about viscerally experiencing contrast. And though it might seem counterintuitive, the experience of contrast, our ability to notice and respond to particular differences or combinations of differences, is dependent on similarities shared by the separate encounters that form the contrast. In Keller's words, Haydn takes advantage of the natural and simple cognitive fact that the same thing seeming utterly different creates a far intenser experience of contrast than do different things. What he suggests here is that the sections of Haydn's music we experience as forming meaningful contrasts have key common elements that help to draw our attention to the elements that are different. We might be very conscious of those common elements, our basis of comparison, or we might not, but Keller would maintain that enhancing how we perceive those common elements can only serve to exaggerate the degree to which we have a vibrant experience of difference in the music that we hear. To unpack this idea, I'll go into quite a bit of detail about how Haydn creates contrast within the first movement of Haydn's two-movement piano sonata in G minor, HOB 1644, written in the early 1770s. Then I'll move on to exploring relationships and contrasts we might hear across different movements and even different compositions. Haydn puts contrast even within the short opening theme to this G minor sonata. The first little segment of the tune asks a question. The second segment answers that question, completing an elegant opening gesture that sticks to a scheme we hear starting many sonatas. Haydn creates contrast here by changing the accompaniment in the first measure of each little segment. In the first segment, the accompanying harmonies sit comfortably in the left hand, below the melody. In the corresponding section of the second segment, the accompaniment is emphasized with sforzandos, and it's split. One note is above the melody, and one note is below. The fact that the harmonies, the primary tune, and even the notes of the accompanying gesture are identical allows that difference in texture to come to the fore. The upper line of the accompaniment suddenly becomes a second melody, and this moment gives us a striking and not necessarily anticipated experience of contrast in only the first four bars of the piece. After this first phrase, we start a transitional passage. A triplet, like the one heard in the opening, leads to four eighth notes, a rising pair of melodic sighs that kick off this bridge section. Though the melodic shape here is different from what we heard at the beginning, the rhythm is exactly the same. An upbeat, here a triplet followed by four eighth notes, and then a long held note. Rhythm provides the basis of comparison, and melody provides the meaningful variety. Secondary themes are usually the source of an important contrast in any sonata. Here, that theme involves a cascading arpeggio followed by a little triplet noodle. After a few measures, Haydn begins a pretty sequence. Elements does this contrasting theme share with what we hear previously that makes its contrasting nature all the more clear? Well, that triplet has stuck around. Here it's almost an afterthought, displaced by those cascading arpeggios. And in the sequential part of the secondary theme, the main melodic figure is this set of descending scales leading to a held note. We might hear them as sped up versions of the opening gesture, that descending scale of a few notes. The music that we heard in the transition passage returns to close off the exposition. The basic shape of the melody is something that we've heard before, but it's striking to hear it developed into a full tune. The melody repeats itself several times in both hands, and when it moves to the left, there's this chirping repeated F in the right hand. It's a very fun gesture that drives this music forward. It's also based on the accompaniment that happened in the transitional passage, where repeated offbeat Fs thud along in the lower voice. That F pedal is a further reason to form a relationship between the transitional section and this closing passage. But of course, the differences between the ways that the Fs express themselves are more interesting than the fact that the same note is repeated a lot on offbeats. The transition passage is held back, the offbeats occur infrequently and are a bit heavy. And in the closing section, the pedal is bright, it's in a high range, and it happens at a much faster rate. As a consequence, it pushes the music forward and gives us a completely different feeling. It's a great example of the same thing, consistent offbeat Fs, seeming different and giving us that intense experience of contrast that Keller was talking about. I don't want to suggest that everything in a piece of music has to come from one particular basis, but rather that the process of making the intuitive comparisons that tell us something is different from something else is helped along when the things we are comparing have something in common. I spent quite a bit of time dwelling on little moments in this movement because the concepts that support these very local contrasts apply to larger scale contrasts as well. One of the biggest questions for those who play, study, and listen to classical music is what makes the various movements of a given composition hang together. Why does this adagio go with that allegro, or this scherzo with that finale? There are many answers to this question, depending on the music's composer or era, and there's no way to guarantee that the movements absolutely must go with one another. But here I will suggest a couple of ways that the second movement of this G minor piano sonata goes together with the first. In the second movement, a turn and then a snappy dotted figure introduces a wandering tune in G minor. Right away, we might note the similarity between this opening move, where a figurative pickup idea leaps up to a descending note, and what happens in that transitional theme I focused on in the first movement. Haydn builds his second movement around this idea that was quite important to the development of the first. But of course, the differences remain striking, namely the fact that this movement is in an almost dancing 3/4 time, and the melodies here have exciting and unpredictable phrase lengths. The G minor sections of the second movement enclose a flowing major key episode, full of quite affective syncopations. In the first movement, smooth syncopations were used to add a bit of swing to a short gesture that closes off sections. They were almost an afterthought, a way to dissipate the energy of previous themes. Where in the second movement they form this expressive climax, a satisfying turn that points to the restorative major key ending of the piece, and once again illustrates how Haydn uses the same rhythmic methods and ideas to produce something that sounds viscerally different. If it is the case that contrast is made more intense when the same thing seems utterly different, then opportunities for making meaningful comparisons across separate compositions are enhanced when we are presented with, say, a couple of three-movement sonatas by the same composer for the same instrument. So for the last part of this session, I'll compare the other two Haydn piano sonatas on this concert program, the sonata in E minor, likely written in the late 1770s and published in 1783, and Haydn's last piano sonata, HOB 1652 in E flat major, written in 1794. My aim in doing so is to suggest that certain similarities that these sonatas have are useful in clarifying how Haydn's musical language differed during these different periods of his life. Many psychology studies have suggested that the basic surface similarity of things we compare can promote our ability to isolate key differences and relate those differences to the larger systems or contexts that each example belongs to. When listening, if we latch on to some figure or gesture found, say, in both of the first movements of these sonatas, we'll probably also get something from the differences that surround such a gesture in each case. Noticing similarities across works can create that visceral experience of contrast I've discussed within and between the movements of a single piece. And more consciously, it could clue us into the fact that these different uses of a shared gesture correspond to the slightly different systems of musical meaning-making that Haydn employed when writing these two pieces. Some of the differences between these two sonatas are fairly apparent. The earlier E minor sonata is in a minor key, and the first movement is a sprightly allegro in the triplet-y meter of 6-8. The other, in E flat major, opens in a noble, almost marchy 4-4 time. The contrast between the first theme and the second theme in the first movement of the E minor sonata is not huge. The first theme is all about a conflict between the staccato lower arpeggio line and the upper lyrical voice. While the secondary theme in the first movement of the E minor sonata is fixated on that lyrical second half of the opening material. The difference between primary and secondary themes in the E flat major sonata is more stark. The opening is a confident, rhythmical gesture. While the secondary theme is this funny little tune which I strangely imagine being played by the soft paws of a cat lightly touching the keys of the piano. There are things that bind the first and second themes of the E-flat major sonata together, the sorts of relationships I discussed in the first part of this session, but rather than dwell on those, I want to focus on a moment in each movement of these two pieces, where Haydn uses the same item from his stylistic toolbox in markedly different ways. At the start of the development section of the first movement of the E minor sonata, Haydn alternates tonic and dominant and A minor. He pauses on an unresolved leading dominant chord, and then, after the pause, he moves deceptively down a third to C major. In the middle of the development of Haydn's E-flat major sonata, we likewise get some quick figures above alternating tonic and dominant chords, here in C minor. He pauses on an unresolved leading dominant chord, and then moves deceptively by the interval of a third to E major. Deceptive harmonic motion of this kind, emphasized by a silence, is something that Haydn does a lot. It's a resource of musical style that many classical and romantic composers draw on, and these moments are just two instances of a trope that is in some ways baked into the language of sonata writing at this time. That we might recognize these passages as sharing a common type makes their differences all the more exciting. In the early E minor sonata, the alternations that establish the key and the dominant chord that dominates our expectations are all in a piano dynamic. And the deceptive motion is emphasized with a forte. In the E-flat sonata, the buildup is very loud. And the deceptive resolution goes to that strange, quiet, chiming secondary theme. There's also a contrast in range here. In the E minor sonata, the two sections of music stay in the same part of the piano. In the E flat sonata, the big chord beforehand is low, and the surprising resolution is up high. Again, it's a moment of hearing the same thing, a particular musical expectation scheme shared by different pieces of music, seeming utterly different, an experience that can provide that emotionally visceral experience of contrast. There's another difference I want to point out between these passages. In the E minor sonata, despite the deceptive motion, all of the tonal areas that Haydn uses are within the realm of E minor. We start in A minor, we go to C major. These are notes in the E minor scale and keys that we might expect to be emphasized in the development of a classical sonata in E minor. In the E flat sonata, Haydn starts the corresponding passage in C minor, the relative minor of E flat, and likewise a normal place to go in a development section. But his deceptive motion goes down a minor third rather than a major third and takes us to E major, an eerie and distant key from the movement's home base of E flat. It's a subtly different tonal move from that in the E minor sonata, one that points forward to the music that will eventually be written by Ludwig van Beethoven or by Franz Schubert. I suggest that the contrast between these moments in these two sonatas is a way to hear how Haydn's ambition for the genre of the piano sonata had changed between the 1770s and the 1790s. In the E-flat sonata, he is embracing a tonal and thematic strangeness that we might ascribe to growth in his compositional style. Again, in the slow movements of these sonatas, I'll look at a particular gesture that they share. The slow movement of the E minor sonata is a careful adagio in G major. The opening phrase ends on a chromatic descent, from a D down to a G, wandering to a cadence in a line that is beautifully marked in the score perdendosi, or losing itself. In a variation on the opening tune that occurs a bit later in the movement, in the second measure, an ascending chromatic gesture slides into a C, the most tending note in the measure's dominant seventh sonority. The slow movement of the E-flat major sonata is an adagio in E major, which, as I mentioned, is a strange and remote key from E-flat. In a central passage in this movement that happens to be in G major, there are a number of upward and downward chromatic runs that prepare a cadence. One particular chromatic run leads up to a C that pulls us toward a cadence. It is the same basic idea as what we hear in the slow movement of the E minor sonata. chromatic run leads us up to a note that fills us with hope for a resolution that will come soon. Again, this isn't a particularly surprising thing to crop up in both of these pieces. We hear these kinds of chromatic gestures all over the classical repertoire. Still, the fact that the feature is shared helps to clarify the differences in the contexts where these gestures occur. In the E minor sonata, it's this variation, it's ornamental, and each note is somewhat expressive. In the E flat major sonata, the gesture is one of many chromatic scales in a passage full of drama and extroversion. In the later sonata, this is not a moment of searching or getting lost. These are showy, operatic chromatics. They make me think of the Mozart operas that Haydn would have gotten to know in the time between writing his E minor sonata and writing this E flat major one. Again, I think this shared gesture clarifies something about how Haydn's writing had incorporated new musical influences by his late compositional period. The third movement of the E-flat major sonata opens with a playful gesture. A repeated G natural, five short notes, popped out, and then a longer one that signals the start of something melodic. Haydn finds all sorts of brilliant ways to vary that repeated note gesture over the course of this movement. Of course, he does it on different notes. He writes off-balance counter melodies around it. He has one repeated note figure stay constant while another slowly moves away, pulling and rubbing against the first and against a chromatic noodle in the piano's left hand. Repeated note themes like this one are not that common in Haydn's earlier compositions. They do occur frequently in Mozart's music. For example, the repeated note gesture that we hear at the start of the finale of Mozart's 1781 Wind Serenade in E-flat comes to mind. Again, I think Haydn's E-flat major piano sonata betrays the ways that Mozart's innovations opened up Haydn's possibilities and contributed to the brilliant music that Haydn wrote in his late period, here exemplified by this creative variation of a same-note tune. What might we compare this repeated note figure to in the finale of the E minor sonata? The third movement of the earlier sonata starts with a sweet and memorable tune marked innocently with an Alberti bass accompaniment. The first phrase of this theme heads to G major. A second section winds its way back to E minor. These passages repeat a number of times in the movement. The theme is subject to a few variations, including this version of the second half of the theme that serves as the final gesture of the piece. In Haydn's variation of the main tune, he hammers out these five repeated notes, and then a long note that continues the phrase, as if to say, "Enough! We've done all we can do with this sweet tune." This earlier Haydn uses a repeated note gesture as a means of creating variety, of realizing a climactic potential for a slightly more normal melody. The 1794 Haydn sees a repeated note gesture as a starting point, something that itself can be varied through articulation, through combination, and through other forms of variety creation. This last relationship that I identified between these two pieces might seem slightly superficial. Again, composers use note repetitions all over the place. But here, this incidental similarity is very useful for clarifying in the ear how Haydn's style had changed by the time he wrote this last piano sonata. And as with the chromatic gesture in the second movements, it's useful for hearing some evidence that Mozart's work had a substantial impact on Haydn's writing. More generally, little distinctive gestures that occur on the musical surface are our main cues for thinking that something might relate to something else, seeing a sameness across different musical encounters, whether those are different themes or different movements or different pieces of music by different composers from different eras, and both emotionally and intellectually gaining something from the comparison and contrast invited by perceiving those common elements. Haydn may or may not have explicitly had all of these relationships in mind, but I do buy Hans Keller's view that the connections and intuitive comparisons that we as listeners make between different stretches of music are very important to having that sense that music has communicated something to us. Recitals like this one, where much of the music shares an instrument, a performer, a composer, might counterintuitively provide some of the best opportunities to have a vibrant experience of musical contrast, and in turn to have that sense that music is interacting with our expectations in ways that leave us satisfied, exhilarated, or enriched when we get to the end of a piece or the end of the concert program. Audio notes are written and produced by Nikki Sweat in consultation with David Finkel and Wu Han. To learn more about Hans Keller's theories on Haydn, check out his book, The Great Haydn Quartets, Their Interpretation, published by Dent Books in 1986. Excerpts from Haydn's piano sonatas were here performed by Gilbert Kalish and Anne-Marie McDermott. And that bit of Mozart's Wind Serenade in E-flat, K375, was performed by Stephen Taylor, James Austin Smith, David Schifrin, Romy de Guise Langlois, Bram van Sambeek, Peter Kolke, Radovan Vlatkovic, and Trevor Knuckles. Audio notes are a copyrighted production of Music at Menlo.